This is Andy Speary, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 29th of January 2013. Andy Speary, Part 3.
You mentioned the Worthies. Did you in your role at Bass actually have much to do with the Worthies? Did you attend board meetings or have...
Oh no, not that high up the echelon. No,
would
no.
You have access to...
I was a very low life form, really. But there were certain people within the scientific side of it who always had a lot to say. And sometimes things were done for, well, people on the technical side of things like myself. They were done for the kudos of Beakers, not necessarily because it was the right thing to do.
Hmm.
But it's dangerous territory, isn't it?
You did get to know Dick Laws, didn't you? He was
director
when you first...
I thought he was a marvellous chap.
Tell me a bit more about him.
Well, Dick was one of those guys that really had done the job, you know. He knew what it was all about. He lived in a hut at Signy with practically no mod cons. A hugely knowledgeable man, but also a very approachable man. Mm. But approachable, you always realised that Dick was the director of the survey, and he always generated that air of respect. You called him Dr. Laws. But you could, if you were quite clever, you could sort of bend his ear. But because he'd been a FID, he knew how a FID mind worked. And one classic occasion, we were on Bradsfield. He was on, I think it was his last trip, actually, and with Eric. And about three or four of us thought, we'll bend their ear about the wages, you see. And we got invited up to the wardroom. Those days, you used to, about three or four people an evening, used to go up before dinner and you had a chance to chat to Eric and Dr. Laws, you see. And we thought, we'll bend their ear about the money, you see. So we had it all pre-planned. And Dick Laws is this cute as cute. He knew what it was all about. And we kept trying to get the conversation to go our way, you see. But it just, it wouldn't quite get there. You know, Dick always just fended it off to one way. And eventually we got the subject round to the question of money, you see. And we just started to talk about it. And I remember Dick looked at his watch. Oh, dear, he said, the time has gone. He said, it's time for dinner. We'll have to go down now. Very, very cleverly done. I admired his whole politics, his whole abilities, really. And he was, I think, probably the best director Bass ever had.
I've heard other stories about him operating at intergovernment level and
overseas
conferences,
clever tactics. Really, the sort of person. Well, I admired him. I just thought he was the business, you know.
I've got some other things to ask about, if I may. You had problems in the late 90s with some of the reliefs when things didn't really go quite as planned, and there was one low shelf relief, which I guess was a Halley.
I did a couple of them, actually. Yeah, they were quite challenging. They could be quite challenging. That one year, we had... Bransfield was... had suffered propulsion motor trouble and couldn't get into Halley really when we wanted to. We were late getting in there. And then there was no sea ice in the creek. We couldn't unload in the normal creek. The ship had to go to the low shelf. And the whole thing was just a bloody epic, really. It was trying to manoeuvre on one motor, and then Stuart was very, very concerned that the ship might possibly get stuck alongside the low shelf. So he was in a hurry to throw everything off and get away. And we had poor weather as well. We had days of indifferent weather, low drift, ground drift, and it was That was a challenge. That was a challenge, keeping those vehicles running and keeping a steady supply of stuff coming off the ship and stuff going back on as well was a real challenge. That was difficult.
There's mention of some of your colleagues, which you haven't really talked much about. Somebody called Mel, somebody called Steve Eady.
Steve Eady was is an exceptional character. Steve was the AIS diesel mechanic when he first went to Hully.
AIS?
Automatic Ionospheric Sounder. And because they kept dumping more and more scientific stuff at Hully, the generators couldn't cope with it. So they bought a containerised pair of generators and shipped it all down there to run the AIS. And Steve was a mechanic that went with them. The generators in their container were profoundly unsuitable for the job because they were bought off the shelf, you know. And Steve made some truly remarkable bits of equipment to make them work. And he did make them work, and he was hugely successful. A gifted mechanic, probably an engineer, really. Steve is an engineer. A very reserved individual and very quiet, but had the ability to be extremely amusing when the opportunity arose. I employed him as a mechanic for ages and until he went onto the ships. He eventually became a fourth engineer on Bransfield. But Steve was the master of the one-liner. We had one young lad who we took as a mechanic stroke driver who turned out to be as dim as a Doc H lamp. He really was dim. And we were sat at Smoker one morning and Steve said, out of the blue, we're talking about all sorts of other things, and Steve just sat there and he said, out of the blue, he said, I think Damien's reached his nirvana. And we said, what? What are you talking about? He said, Damien has reached his nirvana. He's cleansed his mind of all thought. Cracking, real fin stuff. And Steve was a real, you could rely on Steve, absolutely. As long as you got a supply of tea into him, he lived principally on tea and fags. And as long as you could get that into him, then he would perform. Mel was another good chap.
What's his second name? Do you remember? Don't worry.
It'll come to me in due course. He was taken on as summer only, but he had a very, very droll sense of humour and was a bit of a wind-up merchant. A good mechanic, a really great bloke. He had quite an interesting history. He'd worked for Sheffield Corporation on bin lorries and all sorts of other things. He wasn't averse to a bit of dodgy motors, you know. Mel knew all about dodgy motors. And interestingly, the last time I spoke to Mel, which was a while ago, he was actually a Ministry of Transport vehicle inspector. And a better man for the job I can't think of.
There was, Andy, a modification you made to a cherry, putting a cherry picker on the end of a snowcat.
Yeah, when they built Hully 5, Christiansen Nielsen designed it with these filler plates between the wall sections that were held on with self-tapping screws. I mean, there was more self-tapping screws in Hully 5 than the Titanic had rivets. You couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. And when I saw what was proposed, I said to Al, this, what you're proposing here with scaffolding is just never going to work. I said, there was thousands of these screws that had to be screwed in. And I said, you know, they're going to spend all their time moving scaffolding. I said, oh, this is just not going to work. So I made some investigations, and we had an old snowcat in the yard that we was going to be disposed of. And I got in contact with a company called Nifty Lift in Milton Keynes, and they agreed, they were the only company that did, but they agreed to sell us the boom of a cherry picker with just a flat base on it, and nobody else would. Everybody else wanted to sell the whole package, which I didn't want. So we bought this thing, and we made a subframe to fit it on. In fact, actually, Steve Eady helped make a subframe, and we bolted this cherry picker onto the back of a snowcat and put outrigger legs on it and all this sort of thing, stuck a generator on it, and the chippies could then drive along the side of the building and put all these thousands of screws in, and when they wanted, they could go backwards and forwards to an extent without getting off and driving the machine. And it speeded the job up. It enabled them to do the job probably in under a week, whereas it was originally scheduled to take practically the whole season.
Was there ever any comeback on this company, Christian Nielsen?
No.
There was never any inquiry or
no
post-mortem?
No. No, it was... John Newman's probably a better person to speak about it than I am, but I just felt that they used it as a guinea pig. The German Antarctic program used it as a guinea pig to see what would work and what wouldn't. That's the feeling we had.
There's a snowcat that went down a tide crack at one point.
Yeah, that was years. That was probably in the first year of Halley 5, and we had a contingent of army people, and I think some of us in Basque HQ were pretty ambivalent about the use of army people, principally because most army tradesmen never ever get to practice as tradesmen. They do other things. And so there was a lack of hands-on knowledge, but also there was a lack of hands-on sense. and we kept telling these guys, stay on the route, stay on the route, don't deviate. And, you know, they got lackadaisical. They became accustomed to just driving around in snowcats, and they thought they could go wherever they want. And one of them one day just went in the wrong place and put the two tracks on one side of the snowcat into a tide crack. We had a hell of a job getting out of that, you know, 600 foot of water below. And there's a track swimming about in the water. You know. So we did recover it. We did get it out. Yeah. We managed to set some turfers up, and we managed to winch it sideways. We did a little bit of damage to the body, but we winched it sideways, picked it up sideways so that the track was out of the crack. And then I got in it and drove it backwards. So we drove it in an arc so the wire ropes were still taut, and we drove it around in an arc until we got the four tracks back on the ice again, back on the sea ice. But it took a while, to say the least.
And there was a skidoo incident at Rothera where a skidoo escaped, rolled down a slope.
Yeah, that was one of the field trips. The thing about GAs is they ain't experts at anything. They're climbers or what have you, and at that they're very good. But they don't necessarily know all about the operation of vehicles and equipment. And I was out with a bloke, nice enough bloke, and I said to him, before we go down this slope, we really should put both rope brakes on the sledge. No, no, he said, it'll be all right. We'll just put one on. That'll be all right. One will stop it. And I said, what's all about? Anyway, you know, they're in charge of the job. They're taking you out. They're the boss. You go with it. We got halfway down this bloody slope and a sledge shot past. And I thought, I know what's coming next. And sure enough, back of the skidoo comes round and it all rolls down a bloody slope. Great big heap of bits at the bottom. And I said to him, I told you you should have put two rope brakes on it. Didn't do any harm, didn't do any damage, only ego, really. The only accidents I had in the Antarctic were induced by GAs.
Okay. Some tiny details before we come to a conclusion. I've got to ask you about John Newman eating raw bread, apparently.
Oh, yes. We had a cook who should probably remain nameless. Who'd worked in a hospital in Surrey. His bread making skills left quite a bit to be desired, and for the winter that I was with him, I didn't eat bread. It was just awful, inedible. And then in the summer season, one day, John and myself were having a cup of tea in the afternoon, and this cook brought out what looked to be this beautiful fruit loaf. John said, bloody hell, he said, he's done it at last. He's made a loaf of bread that looks as though you want to eat it. So John straight across gets a knife, puts the knife down through it, and this loaf is completely hollow inside. It just had goo in the middle of it. It's just, all he'd done is cook the outside of it. And John's face was a picture.
Did it have much to do with dogs?
No, not really.
They were using your machinery to feed them from.
Yes, we had dogs at Halley, of course. When I wintered at Halley, we had four dogs. And they had we had ice caves at the back of the garage, between the garage and the base. We had ice caves that they were put in, probably, in the worst weather. And they could leave a stream of dog piss the entire length of the workshop, when you took them in and when you took them out. I didn't have much to do with them, really. They needed a lot of time, and time was something that I didn't really have sufficient of. Mm. And I suppose if I was perfectly honest, I'd lack a commitment to it as well. So I was sort of interested enough in the dogs, but only at a very superficial level. At Rotherhithe, of course, there was a lot of dogs. I fed them. I did my share of the chores with them, but I never went out with them, never ran them. That was just too much grief. I'd drag them up the ramp. I'd get a snow cap, drag it all up the ramp. I was happy enough to do that, but I didn't. Dogs were not my thing. They were fed with a Dillis dumper, which gave the mechanics endless amusement watching people start it. People never ever got the grip. You had to swing it by hand to get it to go. And what the idea was, that you swung it as high as you could and kept swinging it after you banged the decompressor over it, and then it would start up and off it would go. And one evening in the early summer at Rotherhithe, it was a perfect evening. It was still, the sun was quite low, so a golden sun. It was just, you could have heard a pin drop. And the radio operator and Pete Cleary, the BC, went to feed the dogs with Dillis. And the radio operator swung the engine and Pete Cleary was sat on the seat. And they swung it like lunatics. But when they fit the decompressor over it, they stopped swinging. So consequently, the engine bounced on its compression and then went back the other way and started up backwards. So Cleary was sat on this dumper. And of course, he puts it in first and it goes backwards. So he thought, well, that's very strange. So he puts it in second and it goes backwards. And while Cleary is trying to sort out what is going on here, the air cleaner on the engine is starting to burn. You see a smoke, flames and all that sort of coming out of it because the exhaust pipe, all the exhaust gas is going through the air filter, you see. And all you could hear was Morris shouting at the top of his voice above Cleary with his dumper, "Switch it off! Switch it off! Switch it off!"
All right.
Cracking.
Phyllis was the name of the dumper truck, I presume.
Dillis, yeah. Dillis.
Oh, Dillis.
Dillis, right. The dumper.
Okay. You left in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
What was your thinking there?
Get out.
Because?
Bass was changing a great deal, and anyway, a very long story short, I was looking for a way out of it because I was ceasing to enjoy the office politics of Cambridge. And two ex-Bass people who had a business wanted me to go and run their fleet of mine clearing machines. And I jumped at the chance and off I went. I've done two really good things in my life. One is going to work for British Antarctic Survey, and the other is leaving it.
You've done 16 Christmases in a row, haven't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Was there also a sense of perhaps getting a life?
Oh, yes, yes. I got married. And I always said, really, that the Antarctic life is for single people. So, and I, repeatedly I went south. My wife was ever so good about it. My wife put no pressure on me. But I knew when I walked out that door, I got on that, as soon as I got on the aircraft at Bryce Norton, I knew the central heating would go wrong. The dishwasher would pack up. Any one of another, there'd be heavy snow and the whole thing. And I just thought, this is not fair. This is not fair. And I just, I needed a break. I needed a change. Exploration Logistics gave me that change.
It's been a fantastic interview. Thank you so much, Andy.
My pleasure. Thank you.